Cohen told the police he saw you going into our yard by the gate. Last night. That's why Kathy was asking you so many questions. My husband stared at me.
But that's impossible. I wasn't there, he said.
Of course you weren't. Apparently, the police have to take an eyewitness seriously, even if he's clearly mistaken.
But...
Robin was outraged. It's so obvious you couldn't have returned, killed the woman, flown back, and conferred with Jeff, only to fly to Atlanta yet again. At least you were at the banquet and the bar with lots of witnesses for a big chunk of time. I'm sure the place was packed.
I'd only been to one previous mystery convention, but the bar had played a major role in the social aspect of the gathering.
Robin nodded.
For at least an hour. In retrospect, it was a bad time to get out of the public sight to talk to Jeff. But we were just so pumped about the plot and how we'd work out who would do what.
His eyes went out of focus.
Well, I said stoutly,
I don't know anyone who wouldn't believe Jeff.
And he'd have had to be an active collaborator in a super elaborate plot for you to have pulled it off, if you even could have.
Even if I'd have Jeff cover for me, to have come home, killed a woman, and returned to Nashville, only to fly back here in the middle of the night? I just don't think it's possible.
No one came to Jeff's room while you were talking? I asked wistfully.
Robin shook his head.
I brightened. The cell phone records will show where you were, right? From the tower pinging or whatever?
I'd read enough mysteries to know that was possible.
Sure, Robin said.
But I had my GPS tracking device turned off. It creeps me out when I get ads tailored to my location. I think it can still be done, even if they won't be able to tell where in the hotel I was. But if I was anywhere in the hotel, I could not be here.
He turned.
I have to brush my teeth before they grow moss.
Of course he didn't think about staying in the bar, I muttered after he'd vanished. Why would he? Just won a major award, the man of the hour, and he goes off to talk to another writer he can email any day.
The flight time from Nashville to Atlanta was just 40 minutes. That was sure a short flight.
Damn. But still, people can't go through airports unobserved and unrecorded anymore. Robin would have had to pay cash for the surreptitious flight to and from. And as Robin had remarked earlier, people using cash for a last-minute flight are conspicuous. Also, he'd have had to get from the airport to our house, which easily took as long as the flight itself, by some untraceable means. And, simplest of all, Jeff was an upstanding citizen, and so was my husband. Robin was in the clear without a doubt, at least in my mind. I knew the police would have to eventually come to the same conclusion. But I also knew how people talked. I knew the presence of two other women in our house, and the murder of one of them would make the mere mention of Robin's possible involvement really juicy. I'd heard the hall shower stop moments before, and I caught a glimpse of a towel-wrapped Philip zipping into his bedroom. In a few minutes, he reappeared, fully clothed.
"How was your run?" I asked.
I wanted to talk about something else besides the murder.
A few seconds better, Philip said. Sarah came to clock me.
I felt relieved and pleased.
Her parents really aren't put off by the...
Dead woman? No, I guess not.
He seemed surprised, and I could tell he hadn't considered Sarah's parents' natural aversion to having their daughter visit a house where murder had occurred.
Josh and Joss were sure excited, though. They want to know if they can come see where she was.
Joss was Josh's twin sister. I felt surrounded by twins.
I'm not going to run tours, I said tartly.
Philip was both resentful and embarrassed. Then I realized I was a jerk. Of course they'd want to see. Human nature. I said, but if they happen to come over here and if you happen to take them into the backyard, it would only be natural to point the spot out.
No touching the police tape.
No one else, though. Seriously.
Philip grinned. It was like the sun coming out.
With my brother's blonde hair, gorgeous blue eyes, and steadily increasing height, I didn't believe anyone would ever pick us out of a crowd as siblings.
I was only surprised that there weren't smitten kids lined up around the block. I had a high opinion of my little brother, though that didn't mean I didn't get exasperated with him at least once a week. Over the months he'd lived with us, I'd learned Philip's greatest attraction was that he was not judgmental. He was truly content to let other people live their own lives as they chose, unless they hurt someone else. And he was kind. This was refreshing to find in a person of any age.
"Okay, I'll call him later," Philip said. "Are you fixing lunch today, or should I just scrounge?"
"Sorry, honey, you'll have to scrounge. I'll cook, or at least arrange, tonight."
"No problem. Remind me to tell you about the party last night that got interrupted. Josh just told me," Philip said.
He turned to go to his room, but then he swung around. He had the guilty air of someone who'd just forgotten to relate a major point.
"Ro, you might want to try to call your mom again," he said.
"Why?"
I went on full alert. "I'm sorry. I just started thinking about, not important. When Josh drove past your mom's street, there was an ambulance leaving. I don't know which house, but you might want to check with her."
I had a flash of exasperation, deeply tinged with fear. I was tempted to let Philip have it for not remembering to tell me earlier, but he looked appropriately unhappy. And anyway, not the most important thing right now. I waved him off as I grabbed for my phone. My true anger was with myself. In the back of my mind, I had been wondering why I hadn't heard from my mother, whether she'd come home or was still at the reunion, why she hadn't texted or called or pounded on my door demanding to know what was happening at my house. Though I had been somewhat relieved I hadn't had to answer her questions, I had been a little concerned. Now I was gripped with panic. Mother answered after 5 rings.
"Where are you?" I asked. "There was an ambulance?"
"I'm at the hospital," she said, her voice dull. "John's had another heart attack."
Chapter 11. In the same listless voice, Mother continued. "He was feeling bad at the reunion. We came home early, thank God. As soon as we took our bags into the house, he collapsed."
"I'm so very sorry. Oh, Mother."
"Yes," she agreed. "This is really serious." My mother, always brisk and in charge of her emotions and actions, sounded hopeless.
"I have to get Sophie situated. I can't bring her to the hospital," I said, thinking out loud. "She should be up in a little while. I'll feed her and get over there."
"John David and Avery are here. When John started feeling off kilter, they decided to come home from the reunion early, too. They were at the house."
These were John's 2 sons by his first marriage. Melinda, Avery's wife, was a friend of mine, though she was so busy with her kids and her community work that we didn't see each other as often as I'd like. John David was a widower.
"I'm glad they're there. Call me when you know something. I'll come as soon as I can, Mother. I'm praying for you and John."
I hung up, almost in tears. Mother had married again late in life, and she and John were very happy together. Avery and John David liked Mother a lot. John's grandkids called her grand-gran, and Melinda was a sweetie. I loved John for himself and because he made my mother happy. Not only did I want John to stay around, I also didn't want my mother to be grieving as I had when I'd lost my first husband, Martin, to a heart attack.
"Ro, what's wrong?"
I hadn't heard Robin approach. He'd cleaned not just his teeth, but his whole self. He smelled of aftershave and soap. I told him the bad news, having a hard time keeping my voice level. Robin said,
"How long until Sophie needs to be fed?"
I looked at the clock and estimated. "She should sleep another half hour, and then she'll need to nurse."
"Why don't I go to the hospital to wait with your mom? When the baby's fed, tell me and we'll switch places."
This was another instance when Sophie's dependence on my boobs caused a lot of complications. People had told me I'd look back on the trials of early motherhood and laugh. But for now, I heaved a deep sigh.
"Thank you,"
I said. That's the best we can do.
Where's Philip?
He's in his room, probably on his laptop. He forgot to tell me he'd seen an ambulance on my mother's street.
No,
Robin winced. Yes, but at least he told me. It's good I called her. I don't think she would have called me until she knew something. I felt my shoulders sag.
I'll tell Philip what's happening.
Robin loped off, and I returned to my gloomy thoughts. He was back in a flash.
Okay, I'm off. While I'm gone, can you look for my keys? I was sure I put them in the bowl before I left. Maybe I missed them.
Okay. Your extra car key is in the bottom left drawer under the microwave. Robin grabbed the key and hurried out the door, barely taking time to pick up a jacket and a book. I fidgeted and prayed and fidgeted after Robin left for the hospital. For once, I could hardly wait for Sophie to wake up. Philip, passing through to assemble a cheese and cracker and soup lunch, asked me if I had any news. Philip liked my mother well enough, but when John, who'd raised two sons, made an effort to know Philip and include him in the family, Philip had responded with affection. My brother apologized all over again for dropping the ball. But then he lingered in the living room in a way that triggered an ominous feeling. Obviously, Philip had something else unpleasant to tell me. Spit it out, I said wearily.
Some kids are saying online that the dead woman was Robin's old girlfriend, he blurted.
The internet has a lot to answer for, I said. This was the last thing in the world I wanted to hear, though I wasn't surprised. I tried to contain my anger since Philip wasn't the one who had been a rumor-mongering asshat.
He didn't know her, right?
Philip sounded hopeful. The answer to that is a little complicated. Philip's face fell.
I was afraid of that.
He didn't know her as a friend or girlfriend, but as his stalker, I said. And she tried to kill me last year. His eyes widened.
The woman who stabbed your maid? That was her?
One and the same.
And she's the woman who came in the house? Looked at Sophie?
I nodded.
That is extremely scary,
Philip said, and I could only nod again.
No wonder she got killed.
But we didn't kill her. Philip nodded.
What was her name?
Tracy Beale. But the police may not have gotten hold of her family yet, so don't put her name on Facebook or any other social media.
I understand, said Philip. And, you know, I'm sorry about not telling you about the ambulance first. Josh told me that some guy fired a rifle into the house where the party was Saturday night. He and Joss were there. It was pretty scary. That sidetracked me.
Why didn't you and Sarah go? I asked, because it was the first question that popped into my head.
Her mom doesn't like Justine's parents. Dr. Halverson and his wife, they were given the party. So, you know, that knocked the ambulance out of my head.
He'd apologized several times now, and I had to accept it. I know you're sorry. I got in touch with my mother. A couple of minutes didn't make a difference, and having someone fire a gun into a house is pretty scary. I'm glad you and Sarah weren't there. Detective Trumbull told me that it happened. Philip, looking relieved, returned to his computer. I began the search for Robin's keys, just to have something to do. He was a regular misplacer of keys. I'd put a special bowl on the island, designated the key bowl. We'd had to search much less often since we'd formed a habit of tossing our keys in that bowl every time we came in. Unfortunately, we'd also started dropping in other odds and ends, too. I overturned the bowl and sorted through the contents, with no key results, though I did find my Starbucks gift card. Then I started checking other possible places. But my mind wasn't on the search, and I came up with zero. I zoomed into Sophie's room at her first little sound and fed her in record time. As soon as I'd burped her, I called Robin. I love to look at our child more than anything in the world, but today I could hardly wait to hand her off when Robin came in the door.
How's John? I said.
Hanging in there, still alive.
I was out the door in 30 seconds. I nodded to Lena, who was walking Chaka, and Jonathan, who was trimming the bushes by his front door, with a tape measure attached to his belt. I took off like a rocket. For a couple of decades, Sparling County Hospital was little more than a way station where patients were stabilized and sent to bigger hospitals in Atlanta. In the last 5 years, it had been growing and competing. Some doctors simply didn't want the pressure of maintaining practices and bringing up their families in the inner Atlanta metroplex, which was about to swallow Lawrenceton. Every year it got closer. Since we had the doctors, a few energetic citizens had started a vigorous campaign to raise money for some of the diagnostic machines necessary to advance our facility to a higher level. My mother was one of them. I was proud she'd worked so hard to make this happen, and I hoped the effort was now going to pay off for her husband. I hurried to the elevators. The ICU was on the third floor. Every moment inside in the hospital raised harrowing memories for me. The smell of the hospital, the glaring overhead lights, the nurse's station, the anguished atmosphere. It all made me feel I was strangling. Though my heart was now with my new husband and our baby, I had loved Martin Bartell. His memory was bittersweet, but it was still part of me. I forced myself to walk into the ICU waiting room. When Avery and John David saw me, they rose to their feet. They were both good-looking men. You could tell from Avery's demeanor that he would never stray from a narrow path. That was not a bad thing when you considered John David's checkered past. How's John? I perched on the edge of one of the chairs so they would sit too.
Still alive, Avery said. Melinda had to go home because the babysitter could only keep the kids until 3. We appreciated Robin coming.
John David was a better man since the death of his wife, Poppy. He was more serious, more determined to provide a stable life for his son. He'd been crying. His brother looked haggard. They had a close relationship with their father. I'm so sorry, I said helplessly. There was nothing else to say. John David nodded in acknowledgement.
Your mom is alone with him now, Avery said. You can go in. It's 2 at a time.
He looked away to hide his anguish. My mother, disheveled for the first time in my memory, was sitting in a chair shoved in the corner. Her eyes were fixed on the man in the hospital bed. John was gray, his face empty and slack. He was hooked up to many devices that blinked and pulsed. His eyes were closed. There was a straight-back chair pushed against the wall. I moved it closer to Mother. Hi, I said softly. Without looking at me, she felt around until she found my hand and she gripped it hard. She couldn't speak. Tears began to run down her face. I wanted to ask her what the prognosis was, what the doctors proposed to do to help John's faltering heart. But in a rare moment of clarity, I understood it was best to keep silent. We held hands, and we watched John's chest move ever so slightly. And we watched the machines register the fact that he was still alive. Together, we went someplace where life was suspended. And all things waited in the balance. From far away, I heard the sounds of the hospital coming from the hall. A food cart rattling, nurses talking, families walking by, phones ringing at the desk. Somewhere not too distant, a janitor was buffing the floor. But in this room, there were only the small clicks and whirs of the machinery. Quiet people went in and out, checking on the machines, checking John. They might nod, but after a look at my mother, they didn't venture to speak. It was clear she didn't want to hear pleasantries or conversation. After an hour had passed, I slowly descended to my normal mortal plane. I began to feel the prickling in my boobs that meant I was ready to feed Sophie again. I glanced at the clock set high on the wall. I could stay another hour in case she needed me. My mother had all she could handle. There was no question of troubling her with the unpleasant occurrences at our house. I leaned over to pat her cheek. I was too anxious about germs to kiss her.
"I'll give one of the boys a turn,"
I said quietly. She nodded without looking at me. Her hand loosened on mine. I left the room as soundlessly as I could and rejoined the world. In the waiting room, John David was asleep in his chair. Avery rose to take a turn sitting with my mother.
"If something happens, please call me," I said. "Mother may not be able to."
Avery nodded. For another interminable hour, I sat uselessly with the sleeping John David and an elderly woman whose lips moved in silent prayer. I was tired and weak, absorbed in my worries and my fears. I didn't even register leaving the hospital until I walked past the fountain in the middle of the circular drive and made my way across the jammed parking lot. When I'd driven here, the dashboard display had told me the temperature was a balmy 75 degrees Fahrenheit, not unheard of for late September in Georgia. Now the wind was making itself known, and the sky to the northeast looked dark and ominous. The air felt noticeably cooler. Another storm. Great. This had been one of the longest and most unpleasant days I'd ever had. The only good thing had been Robin coming home early. If things had been normal, I'd have planned a special dinner to celebrate his Anthony, and my whole family, now including all the Queenslands, would be sitting down at the table. I was hit with a wave of self-pity. After I climbed into my car and turned the key in the ignition, I simply sat there with my hands over my face. I had to move forward. I had to drive home and take care of my daughter. I could not retreat to a dark closet and wail. I made myself think of good things, or at least relatively good things. Robin had identified the dead woman so her family could be notified. If there had to be a dead woman in our backyard, it was good to know her name. No matter what our neighbor Jonathan Cohen thought he had seen, Robin had a good alibi, unless the detectives decided Jeff was not a reliable witness. I couldn't imagine any reason why that would happen. To the lay mind, it might seem fishy that Robin had foregone an evening of triumph to plan a new series in a hotel room with his buddy. But at least he hadn't been in his own room asleep. As I drove home through the dark streets, the great thing, the best of all, hit me in the face. Sophie was safe. Despite the strange and dark happenings in our house, under our roof, in our yard, our daughter remained healthy and untouched. I could only feel deeply grateful. From that relief, I found the courage to pray for John, that his doctors were skilled and discerning, that he would regain health and strength, that my mother would be able to endure this ordeal. It was amazing how much more I felt the power of prayer since I'd had Sophie. Maybe I was whistling in the dark, superstitiously drumming up something to make me feel that I was helping to keep her safe. But I didn't think so. Chapter 12. I called the hospital first thing in the morning, and the nurses told me John had made it through the night. I texted Melinda to get some details. I really wanted to talk to Mother, but she was out of reach in the ICU. I had to try to schedule some hospital time. I wondered if I could persuade Mother to go home to rest. When I got out of the shower, Robin was sitting in one of the living room armchairs. Sophie was lying on his lap, her feet to his stomach. He was talking to her in a manic, high voice.
"Oh, who is the cutest baby? Sophie is. Yes, she is. Look at her little feet."
He tickled her little feet gently.
"Look at her little tummy."
He blew on her stomach.
"Her starfish hands."
He clasped her tiny hands. They both seemed to be very happy.
Robin had moved my purse in his renewed search for his keys. I shoved it back into its accustomed place in the corner of the kitchen counter. Robin told Sophie, "Mama's out of the shower. The milk wagon is here. But let's see if we can play a little longer." He put his fingers in the baby's grasp and then moved them gently back and forth. Sophie gave one of her fleeting smiles.
"Look at her," Robin said. "She's just been playing and playing. Hasn't fussed at all. Even Moosey came over to say hello."
"How did that go?"
"Moosey couldn't have been more nonchalant. She strolled over, sniffed her, sat and looked at Sophie for a few minutes to see if she'd do anything interesting. When Sophie didn't, Moosey went out the cat flap."
"That cat's pretty smart about staying in our yard," I said. "I know this is a minor problem in the big picture of our issues, but I'm a little worried about her. I suspect she's deaf." Robin was surprised.
"Maybe Dr. Lowell knows how to find out," he said hesitantly. "I don't know what a feline deafness exam might be. Why'd you think of that?"
"I don't think Moosey can hear Chaka or Lulu barking at her." I was reinterpreting several past instances when I thought our cat was being either very provocative or recklessly bold.
"Speaking of Chaka,"
Robin said, to my astonishment,
"I wonder what rescue organization the sisters used. I'd been wondering."
I looked at him blankly. Obviously, he was expecting me to pick up on his idea, but honestly, I had nothing.
"If we might get a dog,"
he said hopefully. That was so far from my list of conversational topics that I just goggled at him.
"A dog? We always had at least one when I was growing up."
I'd never applied Robin's mom's love of her two little pets to the likelihood that Robin's family had always had dogs.
"Do you hate the idea?"
Robin was truly anxious. "No," I said, though I wasn't sure that was true. I was scrambling to assemble a response. "I like dogs just fine. I've never had one myself, but I'm sure I can find books on how to take care of one. I have no problem with Lulu or Chaka, except Lulu gets kind of yappy. But Peggy says that's because the Coens haven't trained her. She says if you spend time with your dog, they can turn out fun to have around. I've noticed obedience classes on the community board at the library." "Robin, how long has this been on your mind?"
"Well, since before Sophie, but we had so much on our plate that it didn't seem like the right time to bring it up."
"We're still pretty occupied with our new household member," I said, nodding toward our daughter. Her arm waving was done and her eyes were fluttering shut and then snapping open. She didn't want to miss the party. I was a little concerned that she was falling asleep without feeding, but I was willing to give it a try. Robin was still waiting, hopefully. "Okay, I am not against us getting a dog, but let's let Sophie grow a little bit first, since she's taking up so much of our time and energy." A quiet knock at the door ended the dog discussion, to my relief. Since Robin had Sophie, I answered the door. Detective Levon Suit grinned at me.
"Ro, how you doing?"
"Hi," I said, off balance. I was no longer glad to see Levon. It was unpleasant to realize that our relationship had changed overnight, since he'd become a detective. But I forged ahead. "It's a little early in the morning for a visit. Can I get you something to drink? Coffee?"
"No, but thank you,"
Levon said, ambling by me. I looked over his shoulder to see that the sky was overcast and the air felt damp. Just great. Robin said hello and gestured to Sophie on his lap to explain why he wasn't standing to shake hands. Levon was tactful enough to take the opportunity to praise Sophie, and I felt somewhat warmer toward him.
"Katrina's due to pop at any moment,"
Levon said.
"And we'll have us another one of these."
Levon and Katrina had been married since high school graduation. "That's so great. Have you picked out a name?"
"Katrina's old-fashioned about that. She thinks it's bad luck, like buying baby clothes before the birth."
I had never heard that one, and I thought every tired old superstition and bit of folklore had been trotted out and presented to me as gospel while I was pregnant with Sophie. I was thinking about our bed. Though I'd slept all night, I was still tired. That weakness told me just how sick I'd been. I needed to feed Sophie soon. I should call Aubrey to tell him about John, though I was almost certain he knew already. A cadre of parishioners kept Father Aubrey Scott abreast of all the happenings in his flock.
"What can we do for you, Levon?"
Robin asked. Thank God. He could tell I was zoned out.
"I came to tell you a few things."
"Not to ask them. Great." "We're all ears," I said, and I noticed that Robin and I were actually both leaning forward slightly.
"The preliminary word is that what killed Tracy Beale was a blow to the head,"
Levon said.
"But she didn't land on a rock when she fell. There was nothing like that in the area of her head. So the blow wasn't accidental, we figure. As you probably saw at the crime scene, she'd been holding a knife. At least it was by her right hand. But there was no blood on the blade. She hadn't used it."
That was a lot of information to absorb at one time.
"Okay,"
Robin said.
"Thanks for telling us. Can you say if she was hit while she was standing up or while she was on the ground?"
"Good question." I leaned against Robin's shoulder, which felt very comfortable just now.
"The medical examiner says she wasn't standing upright,"
Levon said.
"But she wasn't lying flat on the ground either. It's a strange depression, Dr. English says. Whatever caused the dent in her skull, it hit her really hard. One big blow. And that's all we know about her death until the ME does a thorough autopsy. Her clothes didn't turn up anything interesting."
"How come she turned up here at all, with no warning?" What little energy I retained was channeled into this grievance. Why hadn't we been alerted when Tracy had escaped?
"We were waiting on a doctor's decision about whether or not Tracy was mentally competent to stand trial. She was in the jail wing of a private psychiatric facility until 4 days ago. Then she escaped."
"No one told us," I said, my anger and my voice rising as I spoke. Sophie's eyes flew open and Robin glanced at me meaningfully. He stood to carry Sophie to her room, jiggling her gently and humming. In a quieter voice, I said, "Levon, she tried to kill me the last time she was out. Don't you think we should have known the minute she went missing?" Robin returned to sit by me. We were waiting for Levon to answer, and we had the same accusing look on our faces.
"I don't blame you for feeling that way, but it was a series of delays that added up to failure. The hospital didn't realize Tracy was gone for at least 5 hours. Then they searched the grounds in case she had committed suicide, probably another 45-minute delay, and a clear violation of the protocol. Then they notified the local police. It's a small force. They were dealing with a 3-car wreck in the middle of downtown at rush hour. Another delay. The staff didn't finish dealing with all the traffic consequences, site cleanup and paperwork until late the next day. Then they found they were supposed to notify our police department so we could contact you. They did call our department. A clerk took down the message and stuck it at the bottom of the paperwork pile on Kathy's desk. She had a backlog because, well, I think she told you we've been busy lately. She didn't work her way down to that message until after Tracy turned up dead. I'm sorry. I understand if you're upset."
Oh, yes, I was upset. Robin was shaking his head in disbelief.
"This didn't go to the top of her pile,"
Robin said, his voice very quiet.
"Levon, maybe you don't understand. The woman who'd already tried to kill Roe, the woman who stabbed her maid, was in the house with Roe and our baby, while they slept, and I wasn't home to watch out for them."
Levon flinched, but maybe he felt a frank apology would be an admission of guilt.
"Tracy wasn't a crazy-eyed lunatic who couldn't think or reason," he told us. "She told her doctor that she'd started reading the works of another mystery writer, Michael Connelly, She didn't seem to be fixating on him in the same way. But the doctor actually told us to alert Connolly, too.
Beside me, I felt Robin stiffen.
And we know how accurate that doctor's opinion was. Tracy wasn't dumb. She could sure understand it was to her advantage to con the doctor into believing she wasn't interested in me any longer.
We should have had the opportunity to judge that ourselves, I said. Though we had come to a conversational standstill, Levon made no move to leave.
You've gotten in touch with Tracy's family?
I said, in as calm a voice as I could manage.
Kathy talked to them. The father's been out of the picture for years. There's a mother and a sister.
In spite of all my anger at Tracy Beale, I felt relieved her family knew what had happened. Everyone should be missed by someone, or at least claimed.
Where was her home?
Robin was walking around the room aimlessly. I was familiar with this restless mode. He'd wander while he talked.
Tracy was from an army family. She'd moved too many times to count. Her mother, Sandra, lives in South Carolina. Her sister Sharon lives in Anders, close to here. And the sister's car is missing.
Tracy took it?
That's what we're assuming. The sister was gone on a camping trip with friends.
Wait, I said sharply. You said Anders?
Yeah, why?
Robin, remember those flowers? The ones without a card? They came from a florist in Anders.
So she was in the area even before I left for VoucherCon.
Robin looked as if he couldn't take much more. I told Levon about the incident, which had seemed trivial but odd at the time. Robin would have been more likely to add two and two since he'd gotten the peculiar emails. But enough of that thinking, I told myself, my teeth clenched. If we'd thought about Tracy Beale at all, and I hadn't, we'd assumed she was safely ensconced in a mental hospital with strict security. I had to concentrate on something else. I was getting angry again. That wasn't going to help the situation. Any sign of Virginia? Maybe she's called her mother. I was grasping at straws.
Not yet.
I wanted to say, then why are you here? But that seemed rude and abrupt.
On the other hand.
But Robin spoke for me.
So why do you need to talk to us? Tracy's still dead, Virginia's still missing, and you don't know what happened to either one. The only new information is that Tracy got hit on the head, which Roe had seen for herself, and she probably took her sister's car. Did the sister let Tracy stay at her home in Anders? I don't believe for a minute that she didn't know Tracy had taken her car.
Sharon swears Tracy wasn't staying at her house, at least with her knowledge. Of course, we've been checking all the motels around here. We were already doing that. Maybe we can pick up some other piece of information. And patrols in this area have been on the lookout for the car.
What's your best guess? I said.
I think Tracy was staying in Sharon's house,
Levon said without hesitation.
And I'm sure Sharon knew. But we'll never get her to admit it, and we can't prove she knew.
You haven't found any evidence of a connection between Virginia and Tracy?
Robin was asking every question that had occurred to me. Levon nodded.
Sandra Beale, Sharon Beale, Marcy Mitchell, even Virginia's half-brother Carlos, all told us they'd never heard either woman mention the other. Since Virginia's personal belongings were gone, it seems like Virginia left this house voluntarily. At least we hope it was voluntarily. We have no idea why she left her car. That's a little scary.
Did Virginia have a significant other? I said.
She'd broken up with her boyfriend 3 months ago. He denies having heard from her. Marcy, that's her mother, says Virginia had dated a couple of other guys. Nothing serious. So much from that end of the investigation. No one heard anything in this neighborhood. No one noticed a strange car. No one saw anything except your neighbor, Mr. Cohen.
And he wasn't right about who he saw. I was still angry with Jonathan, along with almost everyone else. Robin patted my hand.
It seems he wasn't,
Levon agreed.
Robin, we've got people canvassing the Nashville airport, and everything checks out. and your friend Jeff is ready to knock some heads together just because we're asking him to confirm your story.
Way to go, Jeff. It's too bad you can't find her phone, I said. I guess it left when she did. She was really mad when she was talking on it. That has to be significant.
Have you remembered anything? Something she said?
I wish I could help you, but I didn't hear any of her conversations. Or if I did, I was too sick to remember it.
Levon got up to leave.
I'm sorry, he said awkwardly. I know how I'd feel if I saw a stranger in my child's room.
I reminded myself this whole situation was not his fault.
How old is Jeremy? I asked, pulling the name of Levon's son out of the grab bag in my head.
He just turned 2.
Levon grinned.
He's pretty great. This second baby's gonna be a boy, too. That's what Katrina says, and she's always right.
A great talent to have, I said, steering the conversation away from the stormy issues. If people believed Katrina, they could save money on ultrasounds. Just as Levon reached the door, just when I believed this interview was over, he turned to ask us some more questions.
I forgot to ask you if Virginia ever talked to you about her personal life.
Robin and I looked at each other and we shook our heads.
Ro, you haven't remembered anything new about Virginia's first time here?
I was a brand new mom with a brand new baby. A big adjustment physically and mentally. I can't remember us ever chatting.
If you remember who told your mother about Virginia, let us know.
Robin said,
Levon, I hope you won't question Ida about this now. John's had another heart attack and he's in the hospital. It's a very bad time.
Levon looked uncomfortable.
I understand that, but I need to get any information as soon as I can.
I nodded. I'll let Mother know. When I'm good and ready. When Mother can think about something else besides her husband, I thought to myself.
Finally, Levon left, after making sure we didn't have any other scrap of information. We breathed simultaneous sighs of relief when the door closed behind him. Virginia's such a mystery. I didn't know anyone was these days. I didn't even bother to sit down with a book or start something in the kitchen, because little Mrs. Unexpected Nap was over. I sighed. Back to being Elsie the cow, I said.
I'm gonna Google Virginia.
Robin went back to his office. He called,
Ro, did you put my sweater in the wash?
No, I called back. I'm gonna feed Sophie and fold some laundry. I'll check to see if Virginia threw it in the wash, though I don't know why she'd go in your office.
In seconds, we had scattered, relieved to do something that felt normal. I happily entered my mom cocoon with my daughter. We shared the better part of an hour between feeding and playing. I took her into the bedroom with me while I folded laundry, no sweater, settling her in the middle of our bed and putting firm pillows on each side of her in case she suddenly decided to learn how to roll over. I sang to her while I worked, and I talked to her, and I thought about how very lucky I was. Except for Tracy being murdered in my backyard, and my babysitter going missing, and my stepfather having a heart attack. Chapter 13. I called my mother the first thing Tuesday morning. John's condition was stable, and that was good. That day I took 2 more turns sitting with Mother at his bedside, one in late afternoon and one at 10 at night. Mother was silent and stoic, but there were constant tears in her eyes. For the first time, she looked old, though she was not yet 60. Melinda, Avery's wife, came into the ICU as I was leaving. She'd been pulling babysitting duty, so she hadn't gotten to the hospital often. I got both my own kids down, she said. John David came by to pick up Chase. Avery fell into bed. I figured I'd come be with your mom. I hugged her. Mother just won't talk, I said. She just sits and waits. John's a great father-in-law and a wonderful grandfather, Melinda said sadly. I don't want to lose him.
I want the kids to know him, and he's been so happy with your mother. They haven't had long enough together. That's all true and more. We just have to wait and see. I hate waiting and seeing. Melinda managed to smile. Me too. Too much of life is spent doing that. How's Sophie? Well, and happy and enjoying being the center of the universe, I said. And Marcy and Charles? Marcy said a new word the other day. Unfortunately, it was a bad one. Now we have to figure out where she learned it. Charles is walking. He wanted to go with Marcy when she left the room. He just stood up and started across the floor. Your kids are so cute, I said, because it was true and because mothers have to support each other. I haven't had a chance to tell you I'm sorry for all your trouble. Melinda had suddenly recalled that my family had other problems in addition to John's bad health. Is it true Robin had met the dead woman? So had I. She was Robin's stalker. You remember the woman who attacked me in my first house, Tracy Beale? She was supposed to be in a psychiatric hospital, but she escaped. I felt as though I'd told this story many times. Oh my God! You're lucky she was killed instead of killing you. Hearing this out loud made me feel weak in the knees. I patted Melinda on the shoulder and made myself march out the front door. The circular drive was choked with cars, some dropping off visitors, some picking up patients. I stood in the center for a moment, watching the water splash in the fountain. I hoped the sound would bring me peace, but it didn't. I glanced behind me at all the blank windows, all three floors, and knew that behind them lay suffering and grief and pain. I had to remind myself that there was healing, too. When I reached my car, I was grateful to collapse inside. I was a mess. I had to stiffen my backbone. I couldn't heal John. I couldn't resurrect Tracy. I couldn't find Virginia. All I could do was soldier on. I had to drive home, and I had to... All I could think of was going to bed. It had been a long and exhausting day. I still wasn't up to my previous energy level. I fell asleep maybe a second before my head hit the pillow. I know Sophie woke up twice in the night, and I know I fed her, but I was on mom autopilot. When my eyes opened the next morning, I smelled something divine. Coffee and pastry. My heart lifted. Robin had gotten up early to go to Peerless Donuts in downtown Lawrenceton. My appetite came to life with a roar. I staggered to the kitchen in my robe to find Robin at the counter, a box of assorted goodness in front of him. Philip, get off to school? I asked as I poured a cup of coffee. I just missed him, I guess. Yep, Robin said absently. Going by the crumbs, he'd already demolished a blueberry cake donut. He was hovering over the brown and white striped box, taking his time with his next choice. I ate a bear claw, and then a chocolate croissant. Though I'd regret it later, just a little bit. The sugar and fat put me in the happiest place I'd been in a week. Robin looked content, too. We'd been reading the newspaper as we ate, and I'd swap sections with him silently.
When all else fails, eat something bad for you,
he said when he judged I'd had enough coffee to be ready to talk. Thanks for thinking of Peerless. You are truly a great husband. He looked grim.
I'm the husband who brought down a stalker on you when I wasn't even around to defend you,
he said.
I was the one who hired Virginia to come help you.
Don't be ridiculous. You didn't break Tracy out of the hospital, and you couldn't anticipate Virginia would vanish. She was so solid the first time she was here. If you'd asked me, I'd have said she'd be the last person to skip out on a job.
Skip out? I just hope she's alive.
I stared at him with my mouth hanging open. My brain had heard missing and simply categorized Virginia as lost. Like Robin's still missing keys or Sophie's stuffed lamb. It had never fully registered with me that Virginia might well be dead. I'm an idiot, I thought. But after a second of considering the awful possibility, I said, I can't see why someone would kill Tracy and leave her body, yet haul Virginia's away. If you've got one dead woman, what's another one?
Valid point. You think she's still alive?
I nodded. That's what I want to believe, and we don't have any evidence to the contrary.
Robin's face didn't lighten. I wish we knew something, anything for sure. Tell me how John is doing.
We hadn't talked much after my second stint at the hospital. I had run out of conversation.
I shook my head.
The same. Mother won't talk about it or leave the hospital. Every night I keep the phone by the bed in case she calls me with bad news. I was losing the happy buzz of the bear claw and the croissant. Since I'd been thinking about his keys, maybe there was an update. You find your key ring yet?
Nope. They searched my car this morning. By the way, Sam just called on a landline,
Robin said. He put the newspaper down on the counter and looked at me directly. Apparently, we were about to get even more serious. This early? What did he have to say?
He wants you to call him back.
Sam Clarick, the library director, had been my boss for years. Sam wasn't tremendously likable, or witty, or exciting. He didn't much enjoy talking to actual people. But he was an efficient director and a fair boss. I'd exceeded the maternity leave the county policy allowed by many weeks. I was guiltily aware I had an obligation to give Sam a return date, since he was not obliged to hold my job for me any longer, and I was fortunate he hadn't fired me. I didn't want to decide right now, but I'd procrastinated long enough. I covered my face with my hands and groaned. My husband regarded me without much sympathy.
Ro, you've had your mind made up for weeks and you know it. Don't make another crisis out of this.
I was there for so long. Even to my own ears, I sounded whiny. I'll miss everyone. The staff, the patrons.
But you also want to be home with Sophie, and we can afford that. The income from your investments is more than your salary's ever been. I'm doing well. You can't stay at home with Sophie and go into work at the library.
I stared down at my empty cup. There was no advice written in the bottom. You're right, I said. I can't sit on the fence any longer. Before I could think of a reason to put it off yet again, I called Sam. My friend Lizanne answered the phone. You've reached the library, she said in her sweet voice. Office of Sam Clarick. Lizanne, I said. How are you? Hi, Ro. I'm fine, the kids are fine, and the divorce is final, Lizanne said. We need to have lunch, if you can detach your little barnacle for an hour. Sophie was the little barnacle. In fact, she was attached to me at the moment. I was multitasking. So you and Bubba are both free as birds, huh? Bubba has already been on the wing, she said dryly. I saw him out with Teresa Stanton. Shut your mouth, I said. Teresa, a terrifying and impeccably groomed woman, was the ex-wife of another lawyer, Brian Pascoe. Keeping it in the legal family, huh? Lizanne laughed, but then she grew serious. How's your stepdad? I've been so sad about him. He's such a sweetie. I haven't talked to Mother this morning, I said. She's at the hospital all the time, and Avery, John David, and Melinda are taking turns. I go when I can get a couple of hours free. John David calls me when he can. Oh, I feel so bad for him. First he loses his wife, now maybe his dad. Being a single father isn't any easier than being a single mom. Lizanne knew all about that. Bubba had not exactly been a hands-on father even when they'd been together. Lizanne had just told me in a delicate way that she was dating John David Queensland. This was new information. Two separate circles were intersecting like a diagram. I drew breath to ask her how long this had been going on, but Lizanne said, I see Sam's free now, Ro. I'll put you through. My conversation with Sam was terse and unsentimental. If anything, Sam was put out at the prospect of having to interview and hire another librarian. And that was that. I was unemployed. After I hung up, I waited for the regret to flood me. To my surprise, I felt fine. It wasn't likely we would have another baby. I wanted to watch Sophie grow and change day by day. I didn't want to drop her off at a babysitter's house or a child care center every day. I didn't want to be exhausted when I picked her up. I didn't want to resent Robin because he worked from home and could see more of Sophie than I did. I bless Jane Engel, my fairy godmother, yet again, for giving me the financial freedom to make this choice. I felt at loose ends, though I was following the same general routine I had since I'd had the baby. Somehow, it felt different now that it was the way things were going to be. Robin kissed me and went to work in his office, carrying a good sweater from his closet to replace the saggy baggy one he wore while he wrote. After I finished with Sophie, I put the donuts away. They wouldn't survive the day. Philip would descend on them when he got home. I took the monitor with me into the bathroom while I showered, and Sophie was playing in her crib. If you can call watching rotating rabbits playing. Just as I finished drying my hair, Avery called.
"Dad's a little better," he said.
He sounded exhausted.
"I persuaded your mom to go home, to get in bed for a while. If she can sleep and shower and eat, she'll feel better. John David had to go to work, and I have to check in at my office. Melinda's got the kids. I wondered..."
"I'll be there in half an hour," I said.
"Thanks, Ro."
I finished dressing and went to talk to Robin, Sophie in my arms. "I know it's your work time, and I'm sorry to ask you, but today I have to go sit with John. Everyone else is zonked out. If no one makes it back to take over, you might have to bring Sophie to the hospital so I can nurse her in the waiting room." I had a shawl for just such occasions, folded tightly in Sophie's diaper bag. I thought of Robin's absent-mindedness. No keys had turned up and no sweater. "I think I'll take the diaper bag with me," I said. I felt like a camel when I carried both the bag and my purse, so leaving one at home would have my burden. The green and white striped bag with its designer logo looked a lot nicer than my purse, I had to admit. I tucked my driver's license in one of the diaper bag's many outer pockets.
"Sure," Robin said. "I'll put her in her bouncy thing right by my desk. We'll do great, won't we, Madam President?"
I followed him to his office to watch him strap Sophie in. Sophie had begun to conquer the bouncer seat. Sure enough, now she began flinging her arms and legs to make it move up and down. Our baby had learned something. She was beyond cute. I swooped down to give her a kiss on her soft cheek and stretched up to give Robin one on his wonderful mouth. And then I was out the door, bag slung over my shoulders. My hair resembled a bunch of streamers going in all different directions, but today that didn't seem important. I was wearing my green-framed glasses, which hardly seemed appropriate for the ICU, but they did match the bag. This morning, the hospital parking lot was not as crowded as it would be later in the day. As I approached the main door, my shoulders grew tight. The minute I walked through the automatic doors, I would find myself back in a fog of unhappy memories. I gritted my teeth and forced a smile to my lips. The elevator doors whooshed open at the ICU floor, and I waved at the nurse at the duty station as I walked by. They all knew us by now. The door to John's room was ajar. I stood by the bed for a minute or two, searching his face, hoping something had changed. Maybe his color was a little better? I sighed and took the more comfortable chair. I'd left my crossword puzzle book and a magazine here on the previous visit. I tucked a paperback into the diaper bag. I was all fixed for a couple of hours or more. Nurse Dee Dee Powers, chiefly responsible for John on this shift, had written her name on the dry erase board in John's room. Every shift, the primary nurse wiped out the previous name and entered her own. I found it reassuring to know who was in charge. I stepped out